You're here because you're like us, always trying to understand, the deeper currents of history, those unexpected things that really shape our world.
Exactly.
Today, we're diving headfirst into a pretty startling story from World War II. The significant and often overlooked role of methamphetamine, specifically Pervitin, within the German military.
That's right. And we've gathered a range of sources for this article's research papers. They really explore the specifics of this fascinating and frankly unsettling topic.
Right.
Our goal here is really to pull out the core insights. Why and how did the German war machine end up using Pervitin so heavily?
Yeah.
And crucially, what was the actual impact? What did it really do?
And what makes this so compelling, isn't it, is that seeming contradiction. You
yeah.
have the Nazi regime pushing this image of like rigid discipline, moral purity, and yet at the same time, they're fueling their war effort with a powerful stimulant. That paradox is something we really want to dig into.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll also look at how this compares to, similar stimulant programs in other countries during the war. Get a bit of context.
Good point. It gives a broader perspective on this sort of hidden aspect of the conflict. Okay, so where does the story of Pervitin actually begin? Is it a German invention?
Well, the drug itself, methamphetamine, actually predates its heavy use in WWII. It was first synthesized way back in 1893 in Japan by a chemist named Nagai Nagayoshi.
Oh, okay. Japan, 1893.
Yeah. But it was really Germany in the 1930s that commercialized it. In 1937, a company called Temmler-Werk in Berlin, they started producing methamphetamine under the brand name Pervitin.
Pervitin. Got it.
And this followed the work of a German chemist, Friedrich Hauschild, who'd created his own synthetic version.
So wait, Pervitin wasn't initially some like top secret military project. Civilians could just buy it.
Exactly. That's one of the really interesting parts. Despite the whole Nazi public stance against drugs, Pervitin was initially sold over the counter, freely available. Yeah. And it wasn't marketed as, a party drug or anything. It was pitched as a performance enhancer, a way to boost productivity.
What kind of claims were they making?
Oh, some pretty big ones. The ads promised it would fight fatigue, sharpen focus, increase alertness, even improve your mood and suppress appetite.
Sound like a miracle cure for modern life.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
And that widespread availability, within the civilian population, it perhaps made its later military adoption seem a bit less... extraordinary at the time.
So who was actually using it back then, before the military got heavily involved?
Our sources show it was pretty widespread. Students taking it to cram for exams, factory workers needing energy for long shifts.
Makes sense.
Professionals in demanding jobs, even housewives using it for, an energy boost, or maybe as a diet aid.
The diet aid.
Yeah, because of the appetite suppression. There were even these things called Hildebrand chocolates or Flieger's chocolate, Flyer's chocolate.
Flyer's chocolate, seriously?
Seriously. They contained Pervitin, marketed as a way to fight off tiredness and hunger. And they apparently became quite popular, especially, it seems, among women who like the appetite suppression effect.
Flyer's chocolate. It sounds so innocent, but with methamphetamine inside. Okay, so how does it make the jump from, chocolates and study aids to becoming a tool of war?
Well, the military's interest was pretty fundamental, wasn't it? They needed soldiers who could fight longer, march further, stay awake, basically operate beyond normal human limits.
Right, the eternal military goal.
Exactly. So the Wehrmacht saw the potential in Pervitin to push their troops' endurance and alertness. Consequently, in late 1938, early 1939, they started running tests, proper testing programs on military personnel.
And who was overseeing this?
These trials were supervised by a guy named Otto Rank at Berlin's Academy of Military Medicine.
Okay. And I'm guessing the results were encouraging from the military's perspective.
Oh, absolutely. The early findings indicate Pervitin could, keep soldiers awake and alert for way longer than usual, yeah. Significantly longer.
Uh-huh.
People taking it reported feeling more confident, even less fearful. So, based on these apparently positive results, the German military officially approved Pervitin for general troop use in April 1940.
April 1940? That timing is significant, isn't it? Right before the invasion of France.
Precisely. Right on the cusp of launching the Western campaign. That decision right then is pretty crucial when you look at what happened next.
So just before one of their biggest early victories, they greenlight widespread meth use. That's quite a moment. What happened with production and getting it out there?
Well, Temmler-Werk, the company making it, they massively ramped up production to meet this sudden military demand. Millions and millions of Pervitin tablets were churned out specifically for the armed forces.
Millions? How many are we talking?
The scale was huge. Between April and December 1939 alone. So even before that official approval in April 40, they'd already supplied something like 29 million tablets.
Wow.
And then during the Blitzkrieg itself, in the spring of 1940, that number jumped to around 35 million tablets, just in those few months.
35 million pills? That's an incredible number. Was it just the army or everyone?
All the main branches got it. The Wehrmacht, the army, the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, and the Kriegsmarine, the Navy. All of them received Pervitin.
And how did they distribute it? Was it just handed out?
It was a bit more organized than that, at least initially. The methods were kind of tailored. For the army, Pervitin was often packed into field rations or put in medical kits, usually with some kind of dosage recommendation.
Right.
Luftwaffe pilots got those pilot's chocolates we mentioned, and also tablets, especially for long missions. And for the Kriegsmarine, particularly the U-boat crews, it was used to help them stay vigilant during those incredibly long, stressful underwater patrols.
Okay, so there were dosage recommendations. What were they saying? How much should soldiers take?
Initially, yeah, there were guidelines. The standard dose was typically suggested as 1 or 2 tablets. It's about 3 to 6 milligrams, maybe every 6 hours or so. In heavy combat, they might say take 2 or 3 tablets at once. For really extended operations, the guidance could go up to maybe 4 to 6 tablets in a 24-hour period.
And recovery? Did they factor that in?
They did suggest a recovery period after a day or two of use. But, you know, our sources are pretty clear that under the pressure of actual combat, these limits, well, they were often ignored, completely disregarded sometimes.
Right. Orders are one thing. The reality of battle is another.
Yeah.
So how did this Pervitin use actually play out in major campaigns? You mentioned France.
Yeah. The invasion of France, May, June 1940. That's really where Pervitin's impact seems most, well, visible. The sheer amount distributed to the frontline troops was enormous.
And the effect.
It's widely believed, I mean, the evidence points to it playing a pretty significant role in letting the German forces just keep advancing through the Ardennes forest. Nonstop.
Well, without rest.
For up to 3 days, some accounts say. 3 days without the normal need for sleep or rest. Tank crews especially could basically operate around the clock. That relentless pace was absolutely critical to the Blitzkrieg strategy.
Yeah, that constant pressure.
It totally disrupted the Allies' expectations, contributed massively to that swift defeat. It's a key piece of understanding that early Blitzkrieg success, definitely.
That's staggering. 3 days. That's just not normal human endurance. What about later campaigns, like Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia?
Pervitin was definitely used heavily in the initial stages of Barbarossa in June 41. And it likely did contribute to those incredibly rapid advances early on, covering huge distances.
What?
But as the campaign dragged on, supply lines got stretched thin. Just getting the Pervitin to the front became harder. And crucially, tolerance builds up. Soldiers using it continuously would have found it less effective over time. The same dose wouldn't provide the same kick.
Right, the body adapts. And the U-boat crews you mentioned, enduring those awful conditions.
Yeah, for the submarine crews, Pervitin was probably seen as invaluable. Maintaining alertness during those super long, tense, claustrophobic underwater patrols.
Must have been psychologically brutal.
Absolutely. So the drug likely helped them stay focused during high-pressure moments, like evasive maneuvers or attacks, and maybe even helped combat some of the sheer psychological strain of being cooped up down there for weeks on end.
It sounds like, even with the perceived benefits, people were starting to notice downsides. You mentioned attempts to regulate it.
That's right. By July 1941, so about a year after the French campaign, the Reichsheilfuhrer, Leonardo Conti, he actually tried to bring Pervitin under the opium law.
Really? What would that have done?
It would have made it prescription only, basically limiting its availability to the general public, trying to rein it in.
But did it affect the military use?
Not really, it seems. Our sources suggest military consumption just carried on, largely unchecked by these regulations. And by 1944, military doctors were openly reporting widespread addiction problems among the troops. So those earlier attempts at control, they clearly hadn't stopped the military's reliance on it.
Okay, so we've got a good picture of how it got into the military system. Let's really drill down into what this stuff did to the soldiers, physically first, short-term effects.
Okay, physically, in the immediate term, the effects were pretty dramatic. A big increase in alertness, like we said. Soldiers could often stay awake, stay vigilant, for 24, even 48 hours straight.
Wow.
Their physical endurance seemed boosted. They could march longer, fight longer, with less feeling of fatigue. It also suppressed appetite, which, yeah, might seem logistically handy, maybe.
Fewer rations needed.
Possibly. but obviously not good for health long term. Plus, users reported a higher pain tolerance, and some mentioned heightened senses, maybe quicker reactions.
And these physical boosts, did they translate into real advantages on the battlefield?
It certainly looks like, especially early on, enabling those extended operations we talked about, needing less sleep, that's huge. Increased physical output, definitely. Some reports even suggest better tolerance to cold, which would matter on the Eastern Front.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also the idea that it reduced hesitation in combat, made soldiers perhaps more willing to engage, more aggressive.
So physically, it creates this hyper-alert, seemingly tireless, maybe more aggressive soldier. What about the mental side, the psychological impact?
Ah, the psychological effects.
Oh.
Yeah, they were massive and really a double-edged sword. Short-term, users often felt great, euphoric even, more confident, less scared.
That invincible feeling.
Exactly. Increased aggression, a sense of invincibility, definitely heightened motivation. But, and it's a big but, with continued use, the dark side emerged.
Such as?
Increased irritability, turning into real aggression. Paranoia, becoming suspicious of everything, even their own comrades. Hallucinations, impaired judgment, making terrible decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And in severe, prolonged cases, full-blown psychosis, even suicidal thoughts.
That is a really disturbing list. What about just the immediate physical side effects beyond the performance boost? And addiction.
Oh, yeah. Plenty of immediate downsides, too. Cardiovascular stress was a big one. Racing heart, high blood pressure, palpitations.
Yeah.
Risk of hyperthermia, overheating, which is dangerous in combat. Dehydration, too.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers also got tremors, the shakes. Teeth grinding was common. And nasty headaches when the drug wore off. Long term, we're talking serious damage.
Like what?
Severe weight loss, damage to the heart and blood vessels, neurological problems, a weakened immune system, malnutrition, and persistent psychological disorders long after the war.
And addiction must have been rampant.
Absolutely. Tolerance built up fast, meaning they needed bigger and bigger doses for the same effect. Physical dependency developed. Stopping meant withdrawal. And psychological dependency, craving the drug, feeling like they couldn't function without it.
What was withdrawal like?
Horrible, by all accounts. Crushing fatigue, deep depression, intense anxiety, sometimes suicidal thoughts. It would have absolutely crippled military readiness when troops couldn't get their supply or tried to stop.
So this initial wonder drug, it really turned into a nightmare pretty quickly. What were the lasting health consequences for the guys who used it heavily through the war?
Often devastating. We're talking permanent heart damage, increasing their risk of heart attacks and strokes later in life. Neurological issues, cognitive problems, memory loss. Chronic psychiatric conditions like depression and anxiety were common too. And high rates of post-war addiction, obviously. Tragically, it likely contributed to shorter lifespans for many due to the cumulative physical damage.
It's a truly grim picture of the human cost. Okay, shifting focus slightly, considering all these effects, the good and the bad, what was Providence's actual impact on the war's outcome? Did it change things strategically?
Well, there's little doubt it gave the Blitzkrieg a significant edge in those early years, 39-40. That ability for continuous operations, rapid breakthroughs, Prozebintian, seems to have really enabled that specific tactic.
Uh-huh. Any other advantages?
Maybe some short-term logistical benefits, troops needing less rest, perhaps slightly fewer food supplies initially. And tactically on the ground, it could make soldiers bolder, maybe more effective in night fighting, less prone to freezing up under fire.
But these advantages clearly came with major drawbacks as the war went on.
Exactly. Those diminishing returns we talked about, tolerance, declining effectiveness by 41, 42, that was huge. And the addiction itself became a massive liability, a real drain.
How so, operationally?
Well, think about the crash after the drug wears off. Extreme exhaustion. Whole units could become basically useless for a period. Then there's the impaired decision-making, coordination issues. If different units were on different points of the drug cycle.
Yeah, that sounds chaotic.
Unpredictable behavior, paranoia leading to mistakes, maybe even friendly fire incidents. Long-term, you had degraded performance from chronic users, addicted units being less effective, the medical system being strained, dealing with the fallout, and morale issues. It all added up to weakening the German war effort over time.
So it really does sound like a short-term fix with really nasty long-term consequences. What's the general view among historians now? Do they see Pervaton as like a decisive factor in the war?
The consensus now is, well, it's nuanced. Most historians agree it gave a temporary tactical edge, especially in those early Blitzkrieg campaigns, Poland, France.
But not decisive overall.
Generally, no. Many argue its overall influence on German success has been kind of overblown in some popular accounts. They stress that those early victories were complex, down to innovative tactics, training, leadership, sometimes better equipment, allied mistakes. So not the secret weapon some might imagine it to be. Probably not.
Yeah.
You know, military historian Karl-Heinz Frieser puts the Blitzkrieg success down mainly to the right units in the right place at the right time, good planning and execution.
Right.
While someone like Norman Ohler, in his book Blitzed, really emphasizes Pervitin's role. Other historians, like Lukas Kamiensky, place it more within the longer history of militaries using various drugs.
Uh-huh.
And there's a quote from Atif Chima that puts it bluntly. Pills did not help Germany break through France in 1940. They did it because their army knew exactly what and when to do. No one can plan and move like that when they are on meth.
That's a very strong counterpoint. It puts the focus back on strategy and training. So how did Pervitin's impact seem to change across the different phases of the war? Was it always used the same way?
No, definitely not. The impact really fluctuated. Early war, pull in 39, probably a limited effect. It was still early days. Western campaign, France 40, that looks like peak effectiveness.
Right.
Then early Eastern Front, Barbarossa 41, still significant, but maybe starting to wane, tolerance building up. Mid-war, 42, 43, think Stalingrad. The downsides, the addiction problems, were likely becoming much more obvious, reducing its usefulness.
What about other fronts, like North Africa?
North Africa, probably less impact. Supply issues would have been a factor, plus maybe a growing awareness of the drug's limitations by then. On the Eastern Front later, during defensive fighting, it seems it was used more just to keep exhausted troops going, manage retreats, cope, basically.
And late war, 44, 45.
By the late war, Germany's on the ropes. Pervitin was likely used to try and hold defensive lines, keep soldiers fighting despite utter exhaustion. There were even some desperate experiments trying to mix it with cocaine or powerful painkillers, looking for a new wonder drug.
Wow, really?
Yeah, though seemingly without much success. Supply obviously became a huge issue, too, as German industry collapsed. And in the final desperate days, it was sometimes given out in high doses for special ops or Volkssturm last-ditch efforts. So, yeah, its role clearly shifted from a perceived advantage early on to a crutch and then a problematic dependency that ultimately offered little benefit.
That's a fascinating decline. Now, we touched on this earlier. Germany wasn't operating in a vacuum here. What about the other side? Were the Allies using stimulants too?
Oh, absolutely. The Allied forces, especially the British and the Americans, were also using amphetamines. Primarily a drug called benzedrine.
Benzedrine. Okay, different name. Amphetamine, not methamphetamine.
Right. Chemically slightly different, generally considered a bit less potent than Pervitin. The British were actually quite early adopters. They even ran studies comparing it to caffeine.
Mm.
They found similar results on fatigue, but went with benzedrine anyway. They approved a huge amount, something like 72 million doses for their military.
72 million. Huh? Who was getting it?
RAF pilots were officially okayed to use it from late 42. Cancruz got it too famously before the Battle of El Alamein. Even top brass like Field Marshal Montgomery were involved in distributing it, apparently to boost morale in North Africa.
Interesting. And the Americans?
The U.S. military used even more. Estimates range pretty wildly, but somewhere between 250 and maybe even 500 million benzedrine tablets over the course of the war.
Half a billion. That's massive.
Yeah. General Eisenhower himself ordered 500,000 tablets for the troops preparing for ground combat in North Africa in 42. And by 45, some reports suggest maybe 15% of fighter pilots were using it regularly.
What was the thinking behind the American use? Same as the Germans, just fighting fatigue.
It seems their rationale was maybe a bit broader. Yes, fighting fatigue was part of it, but there seems to be more focus on the mood-altering effects, boosting confidence, aggression, morale.
Mm.
Less purely about just staying awake, maybe more about psychological resilience.
Right.
American soldiers even had a nickname for them. Go pills.
Go pills. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Allies were definitely in the stimulant game too, maybe with slightly different aims. What about Japan? We know meth originated there.
Japan had a massive methamphetamine program. Huge. Between 1939 and 1945, estimates suggest they produced around 1 billion doses of meth.
A billion?
A billion, under the brand name Philippon. Like the Germans, they used ephedrine as a base. And it wasn't just for soldiers and pilots. It was widely given to factory workers, too, to boost war production and increase endurance.
And the kamikaze pilots, was it used there?
There are historical accounts suggesting it might have been given to some kamikaze pilots before their final missions, yeah. Though the evidence there is maybe a bit more contested.
Wow. And the aftermath in Japan.
Really tragic. Japan had a devastating post-war addiction crisis. Over 500,000 people estimated to be dependent on Philippon after the war ended. A huge social problem.
That's staggering. So, comparing the scale and the strategies, how does it all stack up?
Well, scale-wise, Japan's billion doses of Philippon is just enormous. Then the U.S. with maybe up to 500 million Benzedrine tablets, Germany's around 200 million Pervitin doses, and Britain with 72 million Benzedrine.
And the drugs themselves, Pervitin versus Benzedrine.
Pervitin and Philippon, being methamphetamine, are more potent, hit the brain faster than Benzedrine, which is amphetamine. Strategically, the German approach seems the most systematic, maybe, especially tied into that Blitzkrieg concept early on.
Right.
The British use seems more targeted, specific campaigns or roles. The American use was broader, with maybe more emphasis on morale, the psychological side. And the Japanese program was incredibly widespread, hitting both military and civilian production.
It really does show that this idea of pharmacologically enhancing soldiers or workers was surprisingly common during WWII, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It really paints a picture of this unspoken, maybe even unconscious pharmacological arms race happening alongside the conventional life. Everybody was looking for an edge.
Well, this has been a genuinely illuminating, if sometimes disturbing, deep dive, a really complex story. To kind of wrap things up, what are the main takeaways you think our listeners should hold on to from this?
I think the key points are, first, that yes, Pervitin likely gave the German military a temporary tactical boost, especially early on. But crucially, this came at a huge cost. Diminishing returns, serious health consequences, addiction that probably hampered them later.
Mm-hmm.
Second, Germany wasn't alone. The Allies, Japan, they were all using stimulants too, just maybe differently and on different scales. It highlights this broader theme of seeking performance enhancement in total war.
Right. It wasn't just a Nazi thing.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe finally, the whole German experience with Pervitin is a pretty stark cautionary tale, isn't it? About the dangers of trying to push human limits pharmacologically, especially in high-stress environments like war. The trade-offs between short-term gains and long-term human cost.
That's a really powerful conclusion. And maybe a final thought for everyone listening. If we step back from WWII specifically, what does this history tell us about the ongoing temptation in all sorts of fields, not just the military, to use substances to enhance performance? You know, are those potential short-term gains ever really worth the long-term risks and the ethical questions they raise? Something to definitely mull over. Thank you so much for walking us through that.
My pleasure. It's a fascinating, important topic.
Absolutely. And thank you all for joining us for this deep dive.